Just a heads up, partially derivative listeners, this week's episode contains some strong language. Welcome to Partially Derivative, the show about data, data science, drinking, and awesomeness. Our top 10 data-related articles and blog posts from the past week, all in 30 minutes, or sometimes longer, depending on how much we're drinking. Links to all stories we discuss today are available on our site, partiallyderivative.com, and on Twitter, at PartiallyD. My name is Jonathan Morgan, and with me is my co-host, Chris, the Denominator, Albin. One thing before we start today, we do want your feedback, friends, so if you have comments, complaints, compliments for the sound of my voice, cool stories about data, shoot us an email, hello@partiallyderivative.com, or holla at us on the Twitter. All right, first things first, let's talk about beer. Dr. Albin, what are you drinking?
First, why am I the denominator in this addiction? Second, I am drinking a Arrogant Bastard Ale, which is a beer that I've always actually been really embarrassed to order at restaurants because you sound like an asshole. Like, I'd take the Arrogant Bastard. So yeah. I've never actually had it before because I've been too embarrassed to order it on a menu. So now I bought it at a liquor store because that's the only way I can order it.
There you go. There you go. And because you were like, I'm the numerator, asshole. Like, hand me my Arrogant Bastard. So I am drinking a beer that's called Wassail because it's a holiday ale. So it's not a wassail. So I don't go wassailing. I go wassailing. And it's by Full Sail. It's actually really tasty. It's a winter ale. It's like 8% alcohol. So I'm basically like drinking wine. If the last couple stories I start to slur a little bit.
It's like the boxed wine of beer.
it's like that, but good. So, so I'll be drinking that while you get into some pretty heavy hitting topics here to start us off. and I'll drink my way through the pain.
Absolutely. All right. Story number one, Tweeting Ferguson, how social media can and cannot facilitate protests. So this is actually a really cool story coming out of one of my favorite blogs turned columns in the Washington Post. The column is actually called Monkey Cage, which is about political science, which as a political scientist, I love the fact that they are in the Washington Post. The story itself is by Joshua Tucker, and it talks about the limitations of Twitter in sparking social unrest. And Tucker's argument is that social media can facilitate protests by giving people information about the protests, let's say where the protest is happening, how dangerous it would be to attend, and that kind of stuff, and also giving them motivation, such as triggering anger or poking group identity and that kind of stuff. And he goes into more details, but needless to say, it is a really interesting take on Twitter information, and I definitely recommend that everyone check it out. For this particular podcast, you know, how is it relevant to data? You know what? So many of us use Twitter data. In fact, I think every single person who has ever been able to call themselves a data scientist has used Twitter data in some way. And, you know, it like when we look at this data, too many people in my mind think about this data as some kind of structured data and don't look at what's called the data generation process, which means how that data is produced for us. And Tucker's discussion of how Twitter matters to people is really important to all of us who use Twitter data to help us understand that stuff that's coming in, right? What are the things that matter about tweets, right? So he relates it into protests, and you know what? I work on data and social good. I understand all this kind of stuff, and I love it. But even if we're talking about everything, let's say from political participation to advertising, how people interact with Twitter and how Twitter either motivates them or gets them to spark into some kind of group collective movement is really important. So it is awesome to see this kind of thing. I recommend you check it out. It's a cool post.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's fantastic, right? Because that really defines the lens. Because I think, like you're saying, most of us use Twitter data to do some kind of analysis about people's behavior in the real world. And essentially we're using Twitter data as some kind of proxy for people's real life opinions and attitudes. And obviously this is a small subset of the population. People engage with the platform in a particular way. Like to a certain extent, their behavior is already predefined or shoved into a box before they start engaging with the platform. And to not think about that, not to have that context when you're looking at your analysis is frankly a little bit dangerous. So it's great to see that somebody's actually, like you were saying, defining that lens for us so we know how we should be interpreting the analysis that comes out of that structured data.
Yeah, absolutely. It's cool stuff.
Absolutely. Awesome. Well, speaking of sort of potentially contentious topical stuff, there is also a really interesting post on 538 this week, focusing on the president's executive order. So this was a big week. The president took executive action to shield about 4 million immigrants from deportation. So immigration is obviously a very hot topic. People feel very passionately on both sides. And that's really the sort of thrust of this post, is that while people can get very emotional about this and about social issues, most of us do, but when you boil down the numbers, it paints a very different story than each side might be trying to tell in sound bites or sort of the emotional strings that they're pulling, right? And so they look at the number of executive orders that each president has taken. And what's interesting is that it actually peaked with FDR, who did, made a massive number of executive orders. And there's been a fairly dramatic downward trend all the way down to President Obama, who's made relatively few. And so obviously there's other aspects to this. You know, the scope of each order is also up for debate, not just the number of orders that each president issued. But I think what's cool about this is that it takes a very emotional, contentious, polarized issue, and it looks at it from a more quantitative point of view. And the chart on 538, we'll link to it from the website, really does boil this down in the way that every great visualization does, to like a simple snapshot look from a particular angle at this kind of thorny issue. So it's a great post and a great visualization.
Absolutely. So I have to say, I love that you brought this topic up, because as a political scientist, this is the type of stuff that I just want to dig in all the time. You know, the first thing you see is that this massive drop-off after Roosevelt, which is exactly, when you're running analysis, that's the stuff you want to see. A flat line is dull, right? If there's a flat line, that is uninteresting in 90% of the cases. But that huge drop-off that you see in the visualization that they provide after Roosevelt, which is, I'm assuming, is because of World War II, is super cool, because that tells you, if nothing else, there is something to be explored here, right? And I get it that there's other ways that we could look at this, and not, you know, executive orders are not all the same, right? Some have incredible, incredible power, right? Because executive orders are enforced as the full force of the law, right? They are law. But, you know, some of them are really, really big. Like the Emancipation Proclamation is an executive order. Whereas I found this one, which was establishing the seal for the President's Committee on the Employment of the Physically Handicapped, which is, I mean, slightly less important than the Emancipation Proclamation, right?
That's what FDR was doing that whole time. He was just doing little bits of house cleaning for the seal and the logos and the... I understand now. I get it.
But, you know... when we look at this, right, so not all executive orders are the same, sure, but looking them just as equal on a plot is still incredibly interesting, to see how presidents are, you know, really taking the full force of the office and doing something with it. And so it's really kind of interesting to see how little Obama has been doing that compared to other people who seem to be doing it to the nth degree, right, really pushing with it. Great visualization, great use of relatively simple data to explain a story that we wouldn't understand otherwise. Good on them.
Yeah, and if you might even say that counting is overly simplistic, it is an interesting counter-narrative to this idea that, you know, presidential power is, galloping out of control. That may very well be true, but this sort of forces us to look at that from a slightly more nuanced perspective, which I think is great.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, next story, in-depth introduction to machine learning in 15 hours of expert video.
That's all it takes? 15
that's
hours?
That's it. 15 hours, and you are a data scientist.
So this comes from
a wonderful blog that I really love, and we will link to it. It's dataschool.io. And two Stanford professors released a really cool online course about statistical learning with applications using R. And that's okay. That's awesome. It was actually probably, you know, a really good course. I've heard really good things about it. But what's really interesting to me is the video part of it. So they recorded a lot of really interesting video content along with the course. And it's 15 hours long. And it is really, really it's a really, really great introduction to machine learning, which is a core complement to any kind of data scientist work. And if you are interested in machine learning, check it out. But the reason that I bring it up is actually something more broadly. I am going to state it right now. We are in a golden age of data science tutorials. I love these tutorials. I try to do all of them. I try to read all of them. I try to listen to all of them. And I get not even close. It seems like every single day there's an incredible new tutorial that comes out, another guide, another book, another walkthrough. I just bought a SciPy book today that released like 2 days ago. That's how, you know, that's how much content is being created in this stuff. There is so much great content out there. If you don't have the funds to, you know, buy, like, let's say, you know, the traditional, like, statistical books that you'd imagine in the class, there's so much free content out there. This is the moment to really jump into data science work. There's so many cool ways to learn it for free, and it's awesome, and this is one of the great ones.
Yeah, and in fact, I totally agree. It really feels like a parallel to the way that web development was maybe, like, 5 or 6 years ago, when there was kind of an explosion in content that was available online, and pretty much anybody could walk in off the street and teach themselves the sort of the skills that they needed to be able to produce really valuable stuff, like stuff that people would pay for. And I think that we're in that same position where, you know, I speak from experience. I don't have a super academic background, but the data science that I've been able to do has absolutely been because there's so much fantastic content online. Showing people the path that they might take to understand machine learning as a practice, understand how to process, you know, how to engage in big data type work. It's all available. And in fact, the content that is online right now is still from incredibly qualified people who are excellent teachers who teach, in this case, at some of the top universities in the States. So this is I'm sure this is a fantastic compliment to what's already out there, and I'm excited to go check it out.
Absolutely. Go watch it.
Yeah, all right. So, and once you learn how to be a data scientist, you can do the coolest thing ever. I am so excited about this story. Okay, so the next thing that we have is data predicts that we'll find aliens in the next 20 years. So I would just like to pause and say, holy shit. This is the coolest thing that I have ever heard. I apologize to any children in the backseat listening to the podcast, but I'm overwhelmed with excitement for how cool this is. So I guess I should take a step back and say, I've had this theory for a while that as a species, humans are like kind of stunted, you know, because we're like flung out here all by ourselves, you know, we're super isolated. So, you know, and then there's this idea out there, right? No, you've done the math. We've examined enough planets. We know that there are like 40 billion Earth-sized planets with temperatures that would make them potentially habitable. So I have to ask, where are all of the aliens, right? This bothers me. This like keeps me up at night. So the cool thing is that what's happened is that using data from the Kepler telescope, and probably everybody's heard about this part, scientists study small variations in light from stars. So they point the telescope at stars way off in the distance, and when the light from the stars change, you can see, or the, you know, as perceived by the telescope, when the light from the stars change, you know that that's a planet passing in front of that star, right? It's like a partial eclipse. And using this technique combined with some other things, they find potentially habitable planets. Cool. So there's this whole field called astrobiology, which is just what it sounds like. It's like the science of studying space data and looking for aliens. So like this is what you can do. After you take the tutorial that Chris just mentioned, you can go be an astrobiologist. And it's awesome. So if you're interested in data science behind extraterrestrial life, you should check out, there's this great lecture. This is another link. We'll put these two together. Lucianne Walkowitz, she did a recent talk about her research at SETI, which is the institute that does the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
And I watched Contact. I know what that is.
Yeah, you know. You've seen Jodie Foster. So she's basically like Jodie Foster in real life. And so her research, get this, is on the quantification of the stellar flare rate. So stellar flare is like a sun flare, which influences planetary habitability and the detection of anomalous stellar variability as a form of signal agnostic optical search for extraterrestrial intelligence. OMG. This is amazing. And so basically what she's doing is she's using like machine learning techniques on massive data sets that are generated by the Kepler telescope and other telescopes to basically determine the atmosphere of planets that might be inhabitable and figure out where the aliens are. Like, mind blown, super awesome. There you have it. This is the best story that's ever happened on the internet.
No, see, this is my issue with it. I don't want to see the first contact with aliens to be some kind of primordial ooze or something like that. What I really want is some Star Wars aliens. Like, if 10 years from now I'm not drinking in some kind of Tatooine like cantina or something like that, I'm going to be disappointed with data science. Although, so, you know, to add a little bit of seriousness to this, I will say that astronomy has long had some of the coolest data science stuff out there. And, you know, those of us who started this field, you know, a few years ago, with astronomy is really like the one place to look for examples of applied data science. And I still have a great, 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 you know, positive feelings and warm fuzzies to all the astronomy stuff that came out there in the early days about using data science, because they were the first one to do all this stuff, right? Normally, you know, even before people started analyzing Twitter, people were analyzing huge clusters of stars using machine learning. Astronomers know what they're doing, man. They are awesome. In fact, I, you know, think that for people who are learning data science through applications, astronomy is a great place to look for some really cool examples and of people using it in an applied way. And there's great books that come out about using data science and astronomy, and you get to go walk along and work with it. Although, I will use one caveat to that my favorite book that is not in the field of political science that uses data science is Forestry Analytics in R, which is an incredible book for those of you who haven't read it, but I don't know anything about forestry analytics. Well, I do now because I read the book, but I don't know anything about forestry analysis or anything like that. That is not my field, but going into another field and watching them how they use data is a great way to learn it. And, you know, I recommend jump into astronomy, jump into forestry analytics, go for broke.
Absolutely. And if you can combine both of those somehow, there's a Nobel Prize waiting for you.
That's a good stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
All right, next story, round numbers. So this comes from Thomas Lumley, but originally came from Amy Hogan, right? So this is something that you probably haven't seen. It comes from a very small blog post. In fact, I think the blog post is less than 100 words. But it shows something really important that I absolutely want to highlight. So if you look at the two numbers that people care about on Twitter most often, they are obvious, right? The number of people who follow you and the number of people who you follow. And these are the numbers that we all pretend that we don't pay attention to. But in fact, late at night, we absolutely definitely check at all times.
All the time, not late at night. I'm going to own up to it. Follow me on Twitter. This stuff matters.
So, when we're, you know, when we're looking at this kind of data, there's these two numbers that come up. And if you look at these two numbers, there's something very, very specific between them. One is a number that a human controls, the number of people that you follow, right? You as a human control that. And the other number is a number that you don't control, the number of people who follow you. And if you look at those two numbers, you see a very distinct pattern. This is what Amy Hogan sort of visualized in a very interesting way. People who end up following people who approach a number that's base 10, right? So we're talking about things like, you know, 10, 100, 1,000, that kind of stuff. They set on that number. So you see these clusters of people around these 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, stuff like that. But you don't see that kind of clustering around the number of people who follow you, because that number is out of your control. And the reason that this is important is it goes back to the idea of the data generation process, that when we are looking at this, numbers that people get to choose, right? Let's say anything from a score of, you know, 0 to 10, how you feel, to the number of, you know, people that you follow on Twitter. If that is determined by a human, that is generated in a way that is different than if nature determines the number. Let's say the number of cubic metrics of water that flows through a river. And that's important to note when we're dealing with this kind of data. It's important to sit down and say, all right, well, the human generated process is different than the natural process for generating data. And, you know, she's identified this, and this is a really clear example of it. And if I ever, you know, go back to teaching more data science stuff, this is an example that I'll use all the time, because it's incredibly important to think about how our data is generated. And one of the first things that you should look at is, are the data generated by humans who are deciding what the value will be? Because they will do certain things, like, let's say, cluster around tens, hundreds, and that kind of stuff, versus something like a natural process, which they won't. Super cool. It's very simple. Definitely check it out. It'll take like 2 seconds to look at it, and I think, you know, you'll have a greater feel for how the data is being generated from human processes.
Wow, that's kind of remarkable that, like, there's such an obvious example that's been staring us in the face for so long, right? This behavior that we all engage in on Twitter. And in fact, I think that that's really the most exciting thing. I mean, I get that we all, you know, we can track real-time news events and whatever, all of the stuff that social networks allow us to do. But the kind of, not really even the digital exhaust, but like the implications about human behavior, like based on the way that we subconsciously engage in these social networks, the way that we're able to quantify and analyze behaviors that we engage in all the time, but don't really have a place to demonstrate them, right? And so as much as I can tweet about my lunch, I'm also inherently giving you some kind of window into my behavior as a human being and the way that I interact with other people. Like it's super interesting that people have been able to use that as a proxy for how we all, you know, live our lives. It's super cool.
Absolutely. Great stuff.
Fantastic. Okay. So speaking of great stuff, so this is ready. This is serious jargon time. Our next story is about a bi-directionalized bi-temporal database. So this is apparently the new black. And before you turn off your podcast, because I just filled it full of like jargon vomit, I want to let you know. So this is basically a new database technology. So it's brought up by Adrian Bridgewater at Forbes, who actually coined the term bi-directionalized. And I will get to that in a second. But frankly, it's by a company called Mark Logic. And it's on the heels, you know, or resurgence or whatever, of all of the database technologies that we've come to use in kind of modern data science. So Elasticsearch, Neo4j is a graph database, Mongo for documents, Redis for key value stores. And if you're like super old school, maybe you've got some SQL database kind of kicking around back there. No offense. Their tech called Mark Logic 8 is basically attempting to solve the heterogeneous data integration problem. So anybody who's had to use data from a bunch of different sources probably already understands this issue. So maybe it's formatted differently. Maybe some of it's unstructured. Maybe some of it is structured. Some of it is highly relational. Some of it maybe has some kind of concept mapping going on. Some of it has a temporal element. So like it's time-based, the context of the data that you're working with, it really matters when it happened. All of these things are different. Like not all data is the same, obviously. And so that's what this whole idea of bi-directionalized, this tool that they created, was that it was a database that houses all of these concepts in a single technology, right? So like one tool to rule them all. And so as somebody who, as a CTO, this is the kind of thing that I see a lot, right? So like it's a very classic like magic bullet kind of technology. And so everybody who hears about it, who's also a CTO or CIO, will instantly want to use it for everything that they can because magic bullets are the best. Like if only I didn't have to build something, if I could find one technology that would solve all my problems, then this is it. And the idea basically is that they claim, this is a quote, integrated search and query of all data, metadata, and relationships, regardless of the data type or source, which is actually kind of awesome. Like for systems that need to consume and process all of this different types of heterogeneous data from like disparate sources, and they don't want to set up like a bulky ETL kind of thing. This is pretty amazing. So, I mean, it's kind of enterprise-y. I have no idea. I haven't used it. So I'm like, I'm not, you know, endorsing it. But just bringing up the idea that we have potentially a technology that integrates a lot of these different, that takes into account a lot of these different, the different ways in which we might need to interact with data, depending on how it's put together, where it came from, and sort of what its purpose is into a single system. So, you know, potentially kind of exciting. Chris, your thoughts?
No, where it, I think it really has a huge amount of value is I love the idea of a wide variety of ways of storing your data. And, you know, when we talk about data, so many of us talk about CSVs as like the wonderful place where data is held. But there's so many really cool ways about storing data, and they have their advantages and disadvantages. And I am very happy to see more ways for people to take on where to put data and those sort of very nuanced definitions of where data can be used and where data can be stored. Go for broke, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Like, it takes some of the decision-making out. Like, I think we're moving towards this, you know, bold new future where to do data science, you don't need to be familiar with, like, a bazillion different technologies in order to do something straightforward, right? Like, that shouldn't be the case. You should be able to work with big data sets based only on your knowledge of kind of, you know, computer-assisted statistics or whatever you want to call it, right? But, like, you shouldn't need to be so deep into the computer science and the technology side, I don't think. Like, I think that's what we're moving towards. Hopefully, we'll get a lot more out of the work that we're doing when we're not figuring out, like, how Redis connects to whatever, some SQL backend connects to blah, 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 blah. So maybe this is the first step in it.
No, that's great stuff. I totally agree.
All right.
So all right. New story. Introducing Charted. So Medium, for those who don't know, Medium is a publication, typically sort of thought of as like an online magazine, but has lots of really cool stuff that they're building. A year ago, the product team at Medium developed a really interesting internal tool to help them share charts. And what it is a tool where you can take a URL that either links to a CSV or links to a Google spreadsheet, and you paste it into a field, and this thing called Charted produces a visualization from it. And it's their way of providing quick and dirty visualizations for things that they care about. And I am a huge, huge, huge fan for this, because you know what? So many of the stuff that we've been dealing with, you know, as data scientists for a long time have been based around, let's say, you know, Matplotlib, which like is a great tool, but is a tool that requires you to define every single part of a visualization. And for most of us, we don't care about 99% of that. We care about that for the very final visualization, but visualizations are a huge part of exploring data. And so being able to take a data set and dragging it into a field and just saying, hey, show me what's interesting, is a really cool part of it. And I think a lot of people who are going to, you know, who do way more advanced data science are going to take this stuff and do really cool things with things like Charted, and, you know, make it that they can take this stuff and provide a really quick use for quick and dirty visualizations. And then they move on to the really more complex stuff. And that's really cool. You know, that's a really cool thing that I think we're going to move into, you know, generally in the future. I use Pandas Plotly. So for those that don't know, Pandas is a package for Python around sort of data frames. But I use their pretty rudimentary plotting function all the time, because you know what? A lot of times I just want to see how the data is distributed. I don't care about making it production grade beautiful. I just want to see it quick and dirty. And it's a really easy way to do that. And so more tools that allow us to do that kind of stuff is awesome. So, you know, go Charted, go Medium. That's great stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think you bring up a good point. Like and I think this is something that is repeated often enough that we almost talk about it as if it's a truism, but it isn't to the point yet where it still doesn't bear repeating, is that it's important to visualize your data all of the time. Like the faster that you can get from some random chunk of data that you've received in a CSV or like quasi tab delimited, turns out random character delimited, like 7 carats delimits like the space between one column and another, or some like bizarre mechanism, like, right? So whenever you can get from that through to the initial initial visualization that lets you make some kind of quick snap judgment about the value of the data that you're working with, like that's fantastic. So I can totally understand the impetus behind building this kind of tool. And it'll be interesting to see where they go next. I noticed that the one thing about this platform is that you have to pre-process all of your own data, which is cool. But if I know how to pre-process my own data, I probably know how to visualize it also. But I do, like, it's a great first step. Like, I guess what I'm saying is I love it. And what I would love to see next is something that also does that kind of pre-processing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay, speaking of companies, super cool data science teams. So Uber has not had a wonderful run lately in the press.
Not at all.
We can say this. As much as we might enjoy the benefits of their very convenient service, they have said some things in public that have made them, they've been sort of on everybody's hate list this past couple weeks. So Chris O'Brien in VentureBeat is riding this wave, perhaps, and he found a tweet that basically called Uber out on pulling down what might be a controversial blog post, especially given the context, right? So the thing that the data science team has their own blog, Uber's data science team, and I'm sure they're all super smart, and their analysis is actually really interesting. The post that they titled was called "Location Knowledge is a Proxy for Uber Demand." But if you look at the URL, it looks like they originally called the post "How Prostitution and Alcohol Make Uber Better." which I don't know. People might find that a little bit. It just sort of contributes to this narrative that Uber is like the most evil startup in the universe right now. So I guess why I bring this up is not so much because if you actually read the post, they pulled it down, but there's a cached version of it that you can go read that's linked to in the VentureBeat article. And if you read the whole analysis, it's actually an interesting exploration, more or less, of location-based data. Like, that's it. They talk about the, you know, complexity of really small parts of a city being difficult to name and define and how that relates to the data that you're working with. All of that's true, and I think it's very carefully worded, and I think that it was a joke, right? I think that it's fair to say that the whole idea that, like, prostitution and alcohol are, like, somehow a benefit to Uber's pricing model or something was a joke. But we do talk a lot about the stories that data can generate, or sort of the stories associated with data. And this one, even though it was tongue-in-cheek, actually is a very powerful story, even if the message was unintended. And I think that it reads as if a bunch of bros have naively conflated correlation and causation, which probably hasn't happened. These are, you know, super smart data scientists, but it contributes to a narrative that Uber doesn't want right now. And I think that the fact that it's backed by data somehow makes it even more powerful, or in this case, even more damning. So, you know, it's one of those situations. It's a reminder that even though we talk about this as a really quantitative field, it's really a lot about the packaging.
Yeah, no. And, you know, this is a case where I think both you and I have a lot of experience in. So, just a little bit of background. Both me and Jonathan work with humanitarian data. We work with very, very, very sensitive data a lot of times. And there is so many cases where we could run a really interesting analysis and we have to think to ourselves, well, maybe we shouldn't, right? Maybe this is not analysis that is helpful to the sort of social causes that we care about, right? And just because you have data about a particular phenomenon doesn't mean that you should run an analysis on it, and definitely doesn't mean that you should write a blog post analysis about it. And right. This is exactly this kind of case where we have something that was probably really interesting to the Uber team, and I'm sure really interesting to academics out in the sort of the field of sociology. But that data is that analysis is very, 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 you know, dubious when it comes to, wait, I'm using this service and you're using it to determine whether or not I'm having a one night stand or whether or not I'm leaving my significant other to go spend time with a prostitute. And, you know, I think it is the fact that they've sort of taken down that particular post is a huge signal to both Uber and other companies that, you know what, people are way more conscious that their data is something that they own and they contribute to companies for their own benefit. But there's a limit to that, right?
So you hear about that a lot, right? Like, this is definitely I think what people forget, or what we forget as technologists and data scientists and whatever, is that we're way at the edge of the bell curve in terms of the amount of privacy that we're willing to give up based on the utility that our data provides, right? Like, I think all of us really believe in the utility of data science and machine learning and artificial intelligence. So, like, if I can give you a bunch of data and you give me something valuable back, whatever, take it, right? I think most of us have that attitude because we look at the cost benefit and we see a lot of benefit, whereas that's not really normal. Like, we're kind of oddballs in that way. And I think it's easy to forget that most people have most people, rightly, I think, have a lot more ownership and are more possessive about their personal data, which, frankly, is probably a healthier position to take than sort of like, screw it. Like, I'd love for you to figure out who I should sit next to on airplanes based on, like, my past history of cereal purchases. Do it! You know? It's probably not super healthy. And frankly, this is a glaring example. Like you pointed out, that, like, there's a disconnect between what we're willing to do with people's data and what people actually feel comfortable with.
Now, I think it's a great point. So I had a statistics professor while I was getting my PhD who very, very, very consciously would always answer every single question that any person who called them on a telephone survey would ask. He would sit down and make sure to answer all those questions. That was his moral position. He's like, I deal with data all the time. People don't answer that data all the time. So I will answer everyone's data point, right? Like, I will be the solid data point in every single person's survey. And, you know, that is a very noble position to have. But for most people, I think they're very conscious of the fact that, you know, this is my data. I want to know how you're using it. And if you're using my own data to determine how whether I am using prostitutes or whether the fact that I am different than people who use prostitutes, both of those, I think, are something that people would be rightly concerned about.
Yeah, totally fair. Totally fair. Yeah, and so you can see why they were a little bit cautious about that being out there in public.
So moving on to the next story, where it is equally depressing for both me and Jonathan. O'Reilly Media, who we both love, released their data science salary survey this month. And it is based on 800 respondents from 53 countries and 41 U.S. states. So we should start with the fact that the median salary is $98,000 in the U.S., which is neither what we earn. But there is some very interesting stuff in the story. I won't go into all the specifics, but I will say a few highlights from the post. So they run a linear regression model on these 800 respondents and all their replies. And so we could say some things. One, if you live in California, you get $25,000, almost $26,000 more money. I'm going to go with cost of living on that one in Silicon Valley and just say that, you know what, like, that's probably not the greatest benefit in the world.
I don't know. I would take $25,000. It's an okay benefit. It's in the middle. It's in the middle.
It is relatively in the middle. Bay Area is expensive, but you get almost $26,000 more. If you are female, you earn $13,000 less, which is a testament to the gender imbalance in this particular field. Although, if you have a doctoral degree, which all the cool people do, you are almost compensate for that with an $11,000 benefit. If you are a startup company, you earn $17,000 less, which I imagine is compensated by the promise of some incredible equity in your company.
I love, though, that, like, let's just pause and say that with a PhD, you can almost make up for the fact that you were a woman. Like, that's... this is sort of a different topic. We could go on and talk about that for a long time, but that is shocking to me that that's what
I think we should set up for this. I think, so, you know, I might be biased in the people that I end up following on Twitter and RSS and that kind of thing, but data science has so many people who come into the field from the basic sciences, from biology, from that kind of stuff. And those fields tend to have a much better gender balance amongst PhD students, not amongst the tenured professors. And so there is so many people, like the fact that there's a $13,000 penalty for being female is insane to me, because all the people that I really love in data science, so many of them are women. So the fact that you would pay $13,000 to be a woman in data science is insane to me. Hillary Mason, thumbs up. She's a great person.
We hope that you are not getting essentially shorted.
Exactly. It's crazy.
15% of your income.
It is absolutely crazy that would be a part of it. $13,000 is a lot of money. A doctoral degree, as someone who has a doctoral degree, is really fucking hard. And if you have, you know, just because of your gender, you have a penalty of more than that is insane. So ask for more money. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the thrust of this. If you make less than the median, you should be asking for more money. So Hit us up on Twitter. Send us an email. Let us know when you successfully got more money at your job thanks to Partially Derivative. That's that's what we want to hear.
Yeah. So in addition to that, the O'Reilly survey has this really interesting part. So they ran a cluster analysis on all the 800 people. So they produced 5 clusters of people who work in data science. And for everyone who works in data science, you should be really, really, really be interested in this because this determines where you are in your high school clique in the world of data science. So there is 5 fields. I will now describe them. If you work in Windows, Oracle, SQL, SPSS, and SAS, you are probably in the big corporate data field. You are the guy who is so freaking cool that he, provides casual clothing on Thursday instead of just Friday. Right? That's
enterprise. That's your,
that's your part. It's compensated by the fact that your bank account is very large. If you are the cool guy who works in Linux, MongoDB, MapReduce, Scala, and Hadoop, you're the hip data science people. You are the people who are working in all the stuff that is the greatest and hippest bleeding edge fields. You probably work at LinkedIn, Google, something like that. Great fields. That is super cool stuff. I wish I did more of that. That's awesome. If you are the person who works in Python, R, natural language processing, SciPy, NumPy, that kind of stuff, you are what I would call the academic script kiddie, which is in fact what I am in that field. So you're the person who is doing the greatest stuff in the world of data science. Possibly not the highest paid, but you're doing the really cool stuff. Go for broke. If you're the guy who does OSX, JavaScript, D3, Ruby, you are the hipster visualization people. I'm going to go with Jonathan Morgan on that particular one. You are the hipster visualizers, front end, whatever, something
and,
like that.
And an academic script kiddie and and a hip big data. I'm all of those things except the rich enterprise guy. I'm just going to put myself, I am in every single category. All right. So don't pigeonhole me, Alvin.
So last category, if you are Unix, C++, Perl, and C, you are the curmudgeons that are telling me to get off your lawn.
That's true even not in data science. I mean, Perl.
No, exactly. This is, I will say, the field that's like, well, why would you use R for that? You could just do everything in C++. I don't understand. So that is a really cool cluster analysis. I think for everyone who works in data science, you might think of yourself in one of these fields. I think most people think of themselves in one of these fields. It is awesome for O'Reilly to kind of put that out there. It's really cool. Go for broke. Definitely ask for a raise if you're in any of these negative categories. If you're not in California, you're female, or you have some startup company, either ask for a raise or ask for more equity.
Do it. Do it, do it, do it. Data science, taking it to the next level. And speaking of that, so this was a really interesting article that I found. Next story, last story, ultimate story. The quote was, "The business plans of the next 10,000 startups are easy to forecast. Take X and add AI." So I actually found this through Chris Dixon's blog. It's actually an article that was published almost a month ago by Kevin Kelly on Wired. So we'll post to both on the website. We'll link to both on the website. But the point is that we're at an inflection point in artificial intelligence. So we finally evolved these technologies to the point where they can be more widely adopted. So most everybody who's into technology understands the shift that has happened in startup culture, where basically everybody who was like sub 25 and could code a Ruby on Rails application could build a startup that would take some process that your company had and used to do with spreadsheets and make it into a super cool company that would get acquired for a few million dollars in a couple of years, right? Like, this was a wave. We're probably at the end of that wave, but it was basically fueled by really easy to use technology frameworks that made it easy for people without a lot of expertise to build really cool, usable applications that solved real problems, and by infrastructure. So there was these two components that really fueled this revolution. So Kelly in the Wired article likens this new artificial intelligence revolution to Amazon Web Services. And that whole thing effectively brought like distributed computing to the masses. So it made it possible to run really... it made it much easier to run complex applications that could stand up under a lot more pressure. And so I think the only thing to point out here, like, I think that this is true, right? We definitely are at a point where a lot of these really complicated complicated processes that you used to have to be able to understand the algorithm from some academic paper, and in the paper it was written in pseudocode, and you'd have to go replicate it yourself in whatever programming language you knew how to write, that's really not true anymore. We have great tools like NLTK and Python, Scikit, and then I guess there are equivalents in R if you still use R. But the point being is that there are some, in languages that are easy for humans to understand, there are toolkits that take away a lot of the complexity from machine learning and artificial intelligence. But we haven't quite gotten to the point where there's a library full of best practices, like a framework where all you really need to do is write some kind of rudimentary instructions, and then your application comes together and just produces the value that your company is supposed to provide, right? I don't feel like we're quite there. It's not as if, like, Natural Language Toolkit and Scikit-Learn are like Django, right? There's not like a Django as a Python framework for building web applications, that basically there's a tutorial and you can walk from the beginning of barely knowing any Python to producing a web application that's fairly complex, right? Goes all the way down from the database layer up through the front-end user interface. And I don't think that we're in the same place with some kind of automated toolkit where you could stand up a production-ready system. I think we could all go away, like Chris was pointing out, there's some great tutorials out there that let people do legitimate data science, like do some complex analyses using modern toolkits, and takes you from start to finish in a relatively short amount of time. That used to be impossible, and that content is out there on the internet, the libraries are open source, that's fantastic, but I don't know that I'd call that production-ready code. And maybe this is just the developer in me who says that not everybody can make production-ready code, like we're not quite there yet, but I think that that's the next step. So anyway, the point being, it's a super interesting article, and it's exciting to think that we are at that kind of inflection point where we're about to see a wave of like artificial intelligence for everything. So I don't know, it's an exciting new world.
Yeah, this is a great piece, and I think Kevin Kelly has hit the nail, you know, on the point. When, you know, so you imagine Web 2.0, we all have had a long discussion of what Web 2.0 is, who anyone has been in this field for a while. Web 2.0, in my mind, was distributing the heavy lifting to the crowd, right? You want content creation, distribute it to the crowd. The crowd will do everything. You want, you know, content identification, the crowd will do it. The crowd will decide what's great. And that's totally cool. And you know what? I have absolutely benefited from that. But you know what's kind of cooler? Using data science to do the heavy lifting and just giving those crowds, you know, the benefit, the end benefit of it. And this is what that's about, right? Right. Taking X, which is in Web 2.0, the crowd, and just add AI. So the to the algorithms and the data science does the heavy lifting around that, and that end user only gets the benefit from it. I agree. I think that's huge. I absolutely think that for the next few years, we're going to see this huge influx of organizations that are taking on things that were based on Web 2.0 and making it, as a competitor to that, making it based on data science, right? Like, I will figure out what is a really interesting article for you, not from the fact that a huge number of people tweeted it, but from the fact that I look at all the language in the article and decide that that's really interesting to you. And we see really interesting stuff that, I mean, there's lots of startups that are just beginning to come into that. So Prismatic, which, as a disclaimer, is run by my friend, is a great example of using the idea of data science to take news articles that come in and deciding, well, based on what you care about or what we think you care about using an algorithm, you should really care about these other articles that coming in. I think that's absolutely the future. This is, you know, in my mind, this is absolutely true. I look forward to the next 5 or 6 years of this being the thing that happens. You know, I think Chris Dixon is awesome for highlighting this. I think Kevin Kelly is, you know, awesome for pointing this out. And I will run with this in the future.
Yeah, let's all do it. Let's all do it. Everybody who's got a cool idea for artificial intelligence, let's make a product out of it and and it will be the next big thing. And that's it for this week. So come back next week for more data science. We hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Next week, when we're all trying to work off the turkey, we can talk about more exciting data and machine learning related news. Credit for the music you hear in today's podcast is by Professor Click. And as always, be sure to follow us on Twitter at @PartiallyD and visit us at partiallyderivative.com. You can also follow me, Jonathan Morgan, at Jonathan Morgan on Twitter, and my co-host, Chris the Numerator Albin, at Chris Albin. Thanks very much for listening, guys, and we will see you all next week.